In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about parenting. Parents, particularly when they have young children, spend a lot of time thinking about prevention. They take their kids to the pediatrician. They make sure that they get their vaccinations. They try to keep them healthy. When they start to walk, they put locks on the cabinets in the kitchen and they cover up the electrical outlets. But this morning, we will be talking about a rather different kind of prevention. And that is the idea that by intervening early when kids are young, it is possible to prevent emotional distress and problems that occur later in life. Well, that's the idea of our guest this morning, Dr. Lawrence Shapiro. He is a nationally known child psychologist. He has invented over 30 therapeutic games used by tens of thousands of counselors across the U.S. and in other countries. He's written over 20 books and workbooks for children. His first book for parents, How to Raise a Child with a High EQ, A Parent's Guide to Emotional Intelligence, was published by HarperCollins a couple of years ago. It's been translated into over 13 languages. And this morning, we will be talking about his recent book, which is titled An Ounce of Prevention. The subtitle is How Parents Can Stop Childhood Behavioral and Emotional Problems Before They Start. It's published by HarperCollins and does basically make this argument that parents can, if they understand what's going on with their children, if they know the warning signs, it is possible by working with them in certain ways to try to head off emotional and behavioral problems before they start, or at least before they get really bad and really problematic. We'll be talking about that this morning with Dr. Shapiro, and as we do, questions, of course, are welcome. Anybody can call in. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can make room for as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Shapiro, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
I think that we certainly know, we've talked about it, the media is full of stories about difficulties experienced by children and adolescents. We know that we're hearing more and more about problems like what we used to call hyperactivity, and as treated in a lot of kids by giving them psychiatric medication. We know we have kids who smoke cigarettes and use drugs and misbehave in other ways, and we know that we have teenagers, particularly girls, who have eating disorders, and it seems that depression is on the rise in kids. A lot of serious problems. Now, do we have to believe that these kinds of things, when they manifest in, say, older children and teenagers, really are related to experiences and conditions that are in place a lot earlier? And if we just knew that and did something about it, we could head off a lot of these problems?
Well, I think that's a presumption of most mental health people. You know, there's a lot of interest in prevention in the schools. And we have all kinds of prevention programs, violence prevention, suicide prevention, conflict resolution programs, drug awareness programs. And for the most part, these have been very successful. Some have been in operation for 20, 30 or more years. So we have pretty good evidence that prevention works. The problem, as I write about in the book, is that parents simply don't have these tools yet. And it's great if your child has exposure to these programs in the schools, but they may not have that opportunity. So it seems only logical that this should be a parenting tool that's available for all parents. There's different things you do at different ages, but obviously the assumption is that most problems, certainly again, either are preventable or you can moderate them. Some problems are genetic, we know that, but maybe you can do things, we know you can do things before they get too serious.
Mm. Something that just occurs to me, and maybe we could talk about it for a minute, is that I think that parents When things go wrong, I think many parents' first tendency would be to blame themselves, and often society does blame them. If we look at children who have problems, we may either think it or we may come right out and say it that, well, obviously, parents did something wrong. And that's probably something that we should try to short circuit up front. And I think it's certainly not your purpose here to do any blaming and to say to parents if kids have problems, well, it's because you did something wrong.
I don't think anybody would want to place blame or reduce accountability. There's been some books recently like The Nurture Assumption comes to mind that says, well, parents really don't make as much difference as we once thought they did. It's more the media or the peer pressure or all these other things that influence, and that explains why in one family one kid has problems and another one doesn't. Same parents. So it's really not to say it's mental health is very complicated. Personality development is very complicated. What I do want to point out is that children have different risk factors. One child may be more at risk for attention deficit disorders. Another child may be more at risk for some other problem. And what parents need to know those risk factors. It is, many of them can be reduced, some of them can't, and know when they're important. And again, just like you would wear a seatbelt all the time, be aware of those, because there's a risk of injury, obviously, in an accident, be aware that your child may be at risk for emotional problems and make it a daily issue, deal with it as part of an ongoing prevention program. Mm.
The book covers quite a lot of ground, more than I'm sure that we can. It covers things like behavioral problems, eating disorders, fears and shyness, problems in sexuality, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, all these things. And it also tries to say something about children across the aid spectrum, so that if there's one of these things that a parent is concerned about, they can go to that section and then they can look at different parts depending upon the age of their kid. So we may be able to say some specific things, but because there is a section here that does deal with risk factors, sort of general risk factors. With the idea that the sooner you start, the better, maybe we can start and talk sort of about younger children and what it is that you're saying to parents they ought to be aware of and tuned into.
Well, I think the most important thing is the issue of temperament. We know that this is a very stable factor and a serious risk factor. Let's just talk about behavioral problems. About 15% of children are simply born with a more difficult temperament, to put it in general terms, and about 15% are a very easy temperament, and everyone else is obviously kind of in between. Now, if you have a child who is temperamentally difficult, and as an infant, he cries a lot, doesn't like to be held, doesn't know how to calm themselves down, resists getting dressed, we know what parents know what a hard baby and an easy baby are like. Well, the message is that is a very stable personality characteristic, and that difficult infant will more likely be a difficult toddler or a difficult teenager or a difficult adult for that matter. And then doing something earlier can make things easier along the way. Shyness is another. We know it's an inborn temperament or inherited trait. We have studies that say that if you treat shy children a certain way, they're likely to outgrow their shyness or their fearfulness. If you don't, they're likely to have it, for the rest of their lives. So temperament is probably the most important trait, which will tell you whether or not there are some things you should be doing very early in a child's life.
Let's then go to the issue of, because I think it's connected, behavioral problems.
Uh-huh.
And today it seems that we, and perhaps we're paying more attention to these things because we now actually have names for them. I don't know what we would have called them in the past. We would have just said, maybe we would have said children were defiant, or they were just difficult, or maybe we would have said they were just bad.
Yeah.
But now we have all people in the child psychology field have names for various things like oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder for kids who were really a lot of trouble. Do we indeed believe that these are kinds of things that are that people are born with, that kids, they're just kind of born that way?
Well, they have a genetic component. There's no question about it. But as I said, there are multiple risk factors, and risk factors are cumulative. So if you are born with a difficult temperament, and then maybe there's a divorce in the home, so that's going to add another risk factor, which could make that problems be more apparent. Or even permissive parenting. Parenting style can be a risk factor. And permissive parenting, along with a temperamentally difficult child, exacerbates that risk factor. If you move a lot and you've got a difficult child, then that's going to make behavioral problems come more to the front. So, again, you've got a number of factors. Some can be reduced, some can't, but it's not a single thing that's contributing to a particular behavioral problem.
And as you said, parents, people who've had children, and they know the difference between an easy baby and a hard baby, and that some their personality is just amazingly sunny. They're very positive. They don't fuss. They don't cry a lot. They're just really wonderful to be around. And then there are others that are just really always seem to be in a bad mood and pretty unhappy, and almost no matter what you do, it doesn't seem to be very much difference. And of course, the one baby is wonderful to have, and the other is can really wear you down pretty quick.
That's right.
But you suggest that there are some things that you can do, perhaps if indeed you have one of the difficult ones, to even at that sort of at that point, really early on, there are things that parents can do to try to encourage in that child more calmness, more reasonableness, and can make them a much easier baby to live with.
Yeah. I mean, certainly from an infant's point of view, we talk about self-calming or self-soothing skills. And we know that most babies, certainly the easy babies, know how to calm themselves down, even if they're, having upset or they're irritable or whatever it might be. They have that internal mechanism that is called self-soothing. More difficult babies just don't seem to have that. But we do know that there are certain things we can do that will, again, not always rush in, not always try and keep them from crying or keep them from being upset, to literally teach them how to calm themselves down. As they become toddlers, difficult babies become more willful even than the we know the terrible twos, for example, is a time when youngsters are making sure that their will is known and that they can be very negative, but difficult babies are even more negative, more harder for parents to deal with. And again, there's a different way of behaving with one child than it is with another.
Yeah, and I think that here, obviously, one of the challenges will be that. That difficult babies are hard to spend a lot of time around. And at the same time, it seems that the answer in some part really is you have to spend time with them. You have to have physical contact. You have to really be tuned into what's going on with them and what it is that they're trying to communicate, to the extent that they can't communicate what it is they're trying to communicate. And I'm sure that that's really difficult if you get to the point where you're stressed and frustrated, and what you'd really like to do is put the baby down and close the door and go, at least go into another room, if not leave town. but that's, how do you deal with the need to be with them and to be really close and intimately involved with them at the same time that it's really hard sometimes?
I think you made a very good point, which is that babies can't tell us what's wrong. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the babies do tell us what's wrong. They don't speak, but through body language, through their cries, through learning to observe their behavior, we can learn a lot about what they need and what they don't need. In other words, whether we think that there's many different types of cries, maybe 13 different cries, a cry of pain, a cry of discomfort, a cry of irritability, and parents can learn to distinguish one cry from another. And know that if it's a cry of pain, something has to be done immediately. If it's a cry of irritability, that might require a schedule change, and that the child is not getting enough sleep or getting the wrong kinds of food. And even things like gestures, babies do develop their own gestural system by 8 or 9 months, and parents, when they learn to pay attention, can even communicate gesturally, even though you don't have a spoken language yet. So communication is something that parents want with their kids and kids want with their parents, and it becomes less of a chore because they're developing a bond. So, you know, we want to look at parenting, obviously, as a pleasant experience and something that is rewarding, and you can do that even with difficult kids.
I should probably at this point introduce again our guest. We're talking with Lawrence Shapiro. He's a nationally known child psychologist. He has invented over 30 therapeutic games used by tens of thousands of counselors across the U.S. and also outside of the U.S. These games cover different areas, things like coping with divorce, reducing impulsivity, encouraging fostering empathy. He's also written books and workbook for children. His first book for parents was How to Raise a Child with a High EQ, A Parent's Guide to Emotional Intelligence. And then there's the book that we're talking about here this morning that's titled An Ounce of Prevention, How Parents Can Stop Childhood Behavioral and Emotional Problems Before They Start. And HarperCollins is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about discipline and about dealing with problem behaviors, and particularly with smaller kids, with toddlers and preschoolers. When children act out, when they're doing something that you don't want them to do, how do you approach that?
Well, I think there are many books on discipline, and there are maybe two or three dozen different discipline techniques. The most important thing is parents have to find one that works. You know, I've had many parents come into my office, and they say, you know, my child's been in the timeout corner 20 times today. Well, you know, what do I do? Well, clearly not that, because it doesn't work. You know, if effective discipline means you don't have to keep doing it over and over and over again, you should be able to do it once or twice, and the child would respond to it. So there's a number of discipline things that parents have at their disposal. Some I talk about in the book, and there are other books as well. And they need to find one that feels right for them and that works with the kids. It is not an exact science, but we do know ways to manage behavior, and parents need to pay attention.
Well, how about give a concrete example?
Well, for example, the first thing we do, which is reprimand kids, and you know, some kids respond to that and others don't. There's a continuum. The next thing is probably the timeout corner, and used effectively, that works. On the other extreme, which is a little more time-consuming, is called an overcorrection procedure, and we recommend that for the more behavioral problems, where you don't just say that's wrong, you don't just punish them, you say you've been rude to me and you've talked back to me, now you've got to make it right, you've got to practice being right, so come in the door and greet me in an appropriate way, say the right words, make the right gestures, hang up your coat, whatever the behavioral problem has to be, and overcorrect it, do it about 10 times, not just once. What that does is that says to the child, there is a better way to do this. I'm requiring you to do it, and we're going to practice it. The problem with a lot of discipline techniques is there's no practice involved. They just get punished for something, and there's no opportunity to learn something new. Another thing which I urge parents with behavioral problems is to think of a positive system. It could be a point system, which most parents have heard of. I like the catch them being good system, where you basically have a stamp or a sticker, or a token, and you literally just look for good behavior. That's basic behavioral principles, and when your child is polite, when they do clear the dishes, when they do put their toys away, give them a sticker, give them a stamp, and catch them being good. The other minor infractions we tend to ignore, but putting it in a positive context makes it more fun and again, shows kids the direction we want them to go in.
Sometimes I think parents run into trouble because they're trying to reason with their children at an age when their children are not able to be reasonable, at least not in the way that we would like. And I think perhaps that proceeds out of a natural desire not to use a kind of system that says, do this because I tell you to. You know, it's the old, this is my house and these are my rules kind of thing. And maybe parents were raised that way and decided to themselves, well, you know, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. It shouldn't just be do it because I say so. It should be do this and here's a good reason for doing it. At some point, though, it does become possible. When does that point arrive when you can actually start to encourage children to think about positive reasons to do things that go beyond because I'm the dad and I'm telling you?
Well, conceptually, it probably doesn't come till 7, 8, 9 years of age in terms of children being able to see another person's point of view or cause and effect. You know, but again, easy kids and difficult kids need different types of responses. You can reason with an easier child, even at a younger age. They probably may not understand the words or everything that you're saying, but they get the intent by your voice tone and by your behavior, and they want to please you. With difficult children, they not only have the communication barrier, they do not necessarily are attuned to your nonverbal behavior, and they may not have the internal desire to please you. One thing we know from a lot of research is that even though today's parents, you know, like to use verbal skills and like to do nurturing and very client-centered, the research tells us that the stricter parents raise, if you will, more mentally healthy kids, kids that are more successful with their friends, with their academics, that have better self-images, so that if you're a parent that has strict rules, high expectations, that's the better way to go than to be more permissive and more, if you will, even more communicative. That's what, it doesn't feel as good, but that's what the research tells us.
Mm. Over the last, well, I guess I'm not sure how long this has been, maybe 10, 15 years, we have seen a fairly steady increase in the numbers of children diagnosed with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and also increasing numbers of children who are medicated for this. And I know it's something that concerns people who are child psychologists and people who are pediatricians, and particularly because we're even starting to see, even though the numbers are small, the rate of increase is pretty significant in preschoolers who are taking these medications, for which they are not. And they're not approved for those age kids, but there are kids there who are on them. What accounts for this this growth in kids diagnosed with ADHD, and is that in any way, again, another of these issues that, well, we have a name for it now, we're looking for it, we're paying more attention to it, and so maybe we're seeing it in places where in the past either we wouldn't have seen it, or because we didn't have a label to put on it, we would have called it something else. Or, again, we would have just said, well, it was a kid who's sort of trouble.
Uh-huh. Well, I think there's a lot of explanations to your question. I think that the first thing is worth saying that clearly this is an overdiagnosed problem. Statistics are, you know, tell us that somewhere between 5 and 7% of children in the general population have attention deficit disorders. But I've been to schools where 20 to 30% of the kids are on medication for attention deficit disorder. So clearly that kind of difference suggests that we are over-diagnosing and over-medicating kids. That being said, it is a real disorder. I'm not one of the people that say, you know, this is all in adults' minds and we just can't tolerate, you know, very active kids anymore. You know, it is real, but probably for 5 to 7% of the cases, and many more are getting medication. Another problem is, of course, that the medication works perhaps too well. So if you suspect there's a problem and you can't find an easier solution and you give a child Ritalin, for example, he's likely going to respond with minimal side effects. So would an adolescent, even would an adult. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think this kid may have a problem. He responds to the medication, and then it's hard to justify. He gets better, and it's hard to justify going backwards. And the third issue, of course, is that parents seem to be having a harder time disciplining kids in an environment where they don't feel they're in control anymore. They have the media to contend with. They have pressures that they don't really understand. And many parents today are saying, you know, I don't know how to be an authoritative parent. Therefore, kids get labeled with problems and may have problems. And another outside influence, such as medication, kind of puts things back into perspective, but it really shouldn't have been out of perspective in the first place.
Well, the chapter on this very subject, your first couple of lines are, this is not a chapter about preventing ADHD. You write that it's a biochemically based disorder. It's not clear whether prevention will ever be possible. And so this chapter is, the title of the chapter is Limiting the Effects of ADHD.
Well, one of the things that we've always known is that some kids with these type of disabilities do very well, and other kids don't do very well. Whether it's ADHD or a learning disability or even a physical disability, some seem to have the capacity to overcome it and some don't. One thing we haven't talked about too much is the resilient child, or maybe we can call them with high emotional intelligence. And the question becomes, even though they have this problem, are there other ways we can teach kids to be more resilient and to compensate? For example, ADHD is not just a problem in the classroom. It's a maybe a bigger problem with social situations. And these kids tend to have a hard time making friends and keeping friends and being accepted. And that can often do more damage than even academic issues. And Ritalin may or may not even help the social issues. But on the other hand, we do know that social skills, such as making friends, such as standing up for yourself, such as dealing with bullies, are teachable skills. So we can make kids, even with problems, more resilient, and that's, again, something that's what therapists do, that's what counselors and psychologists do. What I'm saying is that parents are really the better person to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we should talk or could talk for a moment about resiliency. I think it's interesting that within it's maybe a small but also growing field within child psychology, rather than looking at children who have a lot of problems and sort of ask the question, well, why do they have these problems and where do they come from? This is interested in looking at children that do well, particularly children that do come up in stressful and traumatic environments. Some children will be very damaged by that, but there are also some children that seem to do okay, which leads to this question, well, what are the qualities that enable a child to do well, even if the circumstances of their childhood are less than ideal? What is resiliency all about? What are the qualities of a resilient child?
Well, resiliency seems to be pretty synonymous with what we call emotional intelligence. That there's these set of skills of being able to communicate your feelings, being able to understand other people's feelings or empathize with people's feelings, having specific social age-appropriate social skills, being able to deal with stress. There are things that some kids, as I said, seem to have naturally, but other kids need to have taught. And generally speaking, we find that these are teachable skills, and the ones that don't have them, at pretty much at any age, can learn these skills and can become resilient. I think that's where the real interest is. If you don't have a resilient child, can you make them more adaptable, more amenable to change, and obviously to be a happier and healthier person?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a sort of a checklist here of qualities that you're encouraging to people if they're interested in trying to assess their children in this way. How resilient is your child? You can check off the traits that describe their child, and they are things like has a sense of humor, has an active approach to problem solving, seeks new experiences, makes friends easily, expresses affection openly, is adaptable, and that there are all things that indeed may, to one degree or another, be things that you're born with, but they are also things that you can learn and things that I'm sure that parents can approach or can encourage in their children in as part of their day-to-day interaction, probably easier with when you start younger, but things I would gather that at least once we get up to pre-adolescence, when things maybe become more difficult, the kind of things that you could do with children of almost any age.
Sure. I mean, take something as simple as humor. Humor is something which we know is both important for physical well-being, fights off disease, and helps the immune system. We also know it's one of the critical traits in terms of successful social interactions. When we ask 5-year-olds, what's the most important 3 traits you see in friends? Humor is always one of the most important. And when we ask 21-year-olds, what's the most important of the 3 traits you see in friends? Humor is still the most important. So you can have the kind of household where humor and laughter and games and even childishness is seen as a way to deal with stress. Obviously, kids learn most by watching what their parents do. And if you're the type of parent who's irritable at the end of the day and looking at the bills and, yelling and banging on the desk, clearly that's not a good signal to give to your child. If you're the type of parent who can make a joke, who can, get on the floor and act silly and deal with stress in a more humorous way, then that's another message to the child that humor is an appropriate way to deal with stress. And the interesting thing is that when we look at humor as a resiliency trait, it's not just being able to tell jokes or be a stand-up comedian. That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about the ability to appreciate what's funny, what's silly, what to laugh. It's not the one who's telling the jokes. It's more the one who's laughing at the jokes that seems to be the valued person.
Yeah, and one thing here that it may, in a sense, seem like a simple thing, and yet can be complicated. One of these factors on your checklist that you'd encourage people to go through when attempting to answer this question, how resilient is the child, is able to gain positive attention from others. And I think one of the things that we know is that children will do, they want the attention of others, they want the attention of their parents. If they can't get it in a positive way, they're going to do it in a negative way. They'll be bad and they'll get punished if that's what it takes to get their parents' attention. And if one can shift this around, it's a good thing. But I would think that once you get a kid down the road of, doing negative things and seeking negative attention because that's the only attention they get, how do you get them to change their behaviors and change their orientation so that they're getting positive attention and doing positive things?
Well, they're all different techniques. One of the things, if you're in a classroom and you want the teacher's attention, what do? You raise your hand and you wait patiently. Well, we respect that as a sign that, a positive way to get attention. And if you can just teach a child, rather than whining, rather than when the parent's on the phone, or rather than pulling at their dress or, throwing something, if they just sit there and raise their hand, they're going to get a lot of reinforcement for being patient, being quiet, and signaling them through a gesture that I need to say something. So that's a very simple thing to do. We do it in the classroom all the time. We need to do that in the home all the time. There are other kinds of techniques which we use in counseling. One of the things I frequently recommend is a good behavior diary, so that every day you write down something that child has done through usually their report. They've held the door for someone. Maybe they've written a thank you note, or they've called their grandmother because she wasn't feeling well. But keep track on a daily basis of these little acts of kindness, if you will, and concentrate on the good things. We unfortunately, with these disruptive or difficult kids, we spend all their time on the negative things, and we forget that's not good behavioral psychology. We need to shape behavior by us focusing on the good things that kids do and give them an opportunity to be even better.
We're to the point here where we have about 12 or 13 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is child psychologist Lawrence Shapiro, and what we're talking about here this morning is available in book form, much more than we can touch on in this hour. The title of the book is An Ounce of Prevention. It's published by HarperCollins. It looks at things that parents can do to stop childhood behavioral and emotional problems before they start. That's the subtitle. And your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that we understand that adolescence probably always has been a difficult period, but it seems that it is getting more difficult, and one indication of that is the degree of emotional difficulty that teenagers have. We've seen increases in depression and also problems with using drugs, smoking, alcohol, things that, and perhaps also to some extent food, things that seem fairly clearly to be self-medication. What do you think accounts for the increase in depression in young people?
Well, there's a lot of theories about that, but and frankly, some people blame people like me, psychologists, who 20 years ago were promoting things like the self-esteem movement, and we were saying, you know, just listen to kids and make them feel good about themselves, and you know, praise them all the time. And now the theory is we may have given parents the wrong advice. Maybe we should have been teaching them to be more responsible, to be more accountable. There's just there's so many reasons we can look at. The media, obviously, people look at TV and they look at some of the things that children are exposed to at too early a time. But I think that what we really need to look at is the role of parents that's changing in our culture. And one of the factors has been that as kids grow, parents see their job as being less important, when in fact it's the opposite. As kids become teens, parents need to be more involved than ever, need to step forward into their kids' lives instead of stepping back. That's what teens want, and that's what's more appropriate. You know, when we ask teens, do you think that your parents understand you? They often say, no, they really don't. They don't know. They can't even name, you know, two of my five or six teachers. They don't come to the school. And then we ask them, do you want them to? And they say, yes, we do. We want to talk to our parents. They're the people, that we come to if we want to come to if there's a problem. And parents have this mythology that teenagers are isolated and off on their own, and it simply isn't true. So the teens that do better are the ones with more involved parents.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others here in the time that we have remaining. Certainly we have time for a few callers. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, the number to call. We'll also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Tuscola, and it's line two.
Hello.
Yes.
I just got in kind of in the middle of your session here, Dr. Shapiro. And I have a grandson who's been diagnosed with the attention deficit. But his personality, we keep telling him, he's probably going to be the next James Carey. But he, they took him off his medication. My daughter told the school, she said, my mother said, this will be the last result is to put him on medication. They tried everything else, and they did go ahead and start him on Ritalin. He did well. His grades did come up. And just missed getting on the honor roll. But then this summer, they decided, he said he would like to not take the medication. And his reasoning was, and he didn't want to take it when he started to school, is because when they go to school, they have them all line up in a row to take their medication in front of everybody. So he did not want to do that. So they have changed him and put him on a medication now that it's just once a day. So they've started him on that to see if that works. Any comments?
Well, I think you make one good point, is that we often don't ask kids, what do you feel about being on medication?
Right.
And, there are some people that feel that is the psychological side effect, that we're literally telling them, listen, drugs are good. Drugs are helpful. They can change your mood. They can change your behavior. It's not a good message.
Right. Agreed.
For young kids. So I think we have to look at medication with kids very scientifically, if you will. And the problem I don't like to see is when, it doesn't sound like this is the case with your grandson, but parents often become the kind of arbiter of when a kid should be on medication and when they shouldn't. For example, the physician might say just during school days, but on the weekend, the parent might say, well, you know, I'm going shopping and I really want him to behave. I'll give him a pill, and I know he'll be calmer in the mall. Well, that's not a parent's role. Parents, you know, don't want to become controlling their kids.
Oh, absolutely. And she tried, and she went to all of the officials. She went to the doctors before they ever did anything, and she could not convince the school. The first thing when she told them about, you know, he was having some problems with his studies and his attention and whatever, the first thing they did, well, we'll put him on Ritalin. She said, no, we won't. My mother says that that's going to be the last resort. And it was. So she went all through the channels, and the school is now working with her really well. But then this this came up, and when it came back to going back to the medication, that he just felt really bad. All the kids at school knew that, you know, and they, you know how kids are. They put a name on you and whatever when you're standing in line to get your medication. And so I that was unbelievable to me to think that they just had him standing in a line to get their medication.
Well, unfortunately, that's happened all too frequently, and the answer, which you've already found, is there are some new medications that you only have to take once a day, and that
right.
does at least alleviate some of the stigma. But the other comment I'd make is I think what all our studies tell us is that Ritalin and similar medications help the immediate behavior, but they really don't help the long-term behavior. These medications should be used with behavioral programs or, as I mentioned, social skills training or self-control training. And we know these things work well when you're on medication.
Mm-hmm.
So what I urge people to do is don't, just because the medication works, don't forget that it is a pill and it does change things in the short run, but it's going to be out of the child's system when you stop taking the pill, and look at it more as a way to learn to behave, much the way if you were teaching a child to swim, you have a life jacket or life preserver, but the goal is to teach them to swim by itself and to get rid of that device. And the same thing with Ritalin. It really should just, or again, other medications, it makes it easier to help the child develop their own level of self-control, but it's not really a long-term answer.
Right. Well, he has a personality that is, I would hate to see that altered in any way, because
sure.
he is just a nice young man. He does have the social skills to work with people, but his big thing was concentrating to get his studies, supposedly, and whatever. So that's kind of where the Ritalin came in.
Well, good. Well, it sounds like people put a lot of thought into it, and that's a good thing for parents and a good thing for this child.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, too, that sometimes it's an easy way for parents to take and out, give them a pill, and they don't have to do their job.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
I appreciate talking with you, and I definitely will be at the bookstore.
All right. Well, let's take one more caller here, and that would be in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. It's a great show. Can you address inculcating trust and honesty with kids, tasks for getting kids to take responsibility for mistakes they might make in a constructive way?
What age group are we talking about?
Preschool, 4 or 5.
Well, you know, there's a lot of values education programs are out there. It could be through books. It could be through videos. I mean, I think it's got to be a discussion that parents have, and as well as a behavioral program to punish a child if they're being dishonest or taking something or breaking rules. But developmentally speaking, we know that there's kind of a slow curve. By 5, most children really understand what honesty is about, and they're almost hyper honest. They if you ask 5- and 6-year-olds, is it ever right to tell a lie, though almost 95% will say, no, absolutely not. You always have to be honest. Mm-hmm. And then it's a kind of a slow descent. By 11, we ask kids, is it ever right to lie? And about 90% will say, yeah, sometimes it is. So what happens is that they learn, the 5-year-olds are concrete thinkers, and they think you always have to tell the truth. By 11, they realize there are certain situations, maybe it hurts someone's feelings, or maybe you actually might help someone else by telling a white lie. The only way to help kids with that distinction, it's not a black and white world, is to teach them values and live those values with them, and then they're going to be, you know, honest, good, thoughtful, moral kids. Hmm.
We're just about at the point that we are going to have to finish up. Is there last sort of thought that you might like to leave with folks?
Well, you know, I talk about a lot of different ideas in the book, but the most important thing is to understand that prevention is a daily issue. It's not, you know, you don't say we're going to wear our seatbelt today, but tomorrow, you know, we don't have to, or it's got to be done every day or it doesn't have any effect. So I urge parents to take 15 minutes a day, you know, roughly the time it would take to tell a bedtime story and tuck them in, and think about prevention. You know, teach them some of these skills or work to reduce some of the stresses that are on your child. But make it a daily habit, and then you're going to really make a difference in your child's life. Doing it when you think about it, doing it once in a while, is not going to make, unfortunately, a tremendous difference. So just think that this is a parenting issue, a parenting tool that you've got to deal with on a daily basis.
Well, there we will finish. We say to you, Dr. Shapiro, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Our guest, Dr. Lawrence Shapiro, he is a child psychologist, and the book that we've talked about, if you'd like to look at it, is titled An Ounce of Prevention. The subtitle, How Parents Can Stop Childhood Behavioral and Emotional Problems Before They Start. It's published by HarperCollins.